You are listening to a Documentally podcast. Episode 10. Fancy a worldwide revolution of spirit? In this episode, meet Martin Polykoff. In the 70s, he sold Enlightenment for £169. We talk about the myth of Castaneda, the secret of happiness, and how Enlightenment can get you laid, but it might not make you happy. Well, hello, and for this episode of Documentally, I'm in Northwest Wales. I'm in Northwest Wales on the side of a mountain. It's absolutely beautiful. I can see the sea from here. I'm actually here with Martin Polykoff. Did I pronounce that?
Yeah, it's absolutely perfect.
Now, I'm here talking to you today because you've done a few interesting things and are still doing a few interesting things. Now, at the moment, you are a...
Psychotherapist.
Yeah. You started a doctorate in shamanism.
I did 5 years of that, yes.
5 years. How is that connected with what you're doing now?
Well, in a way it's connected because it's about imaginal change, using the imagination to create change.
Yeah.
So it's connected in that way.
If someone's listening to this and they have no idea what shamanism is,
yeah,
how could you explain it in a short paragraph?
A shaman is somebody who heals others through trance. He or she takes a trance and they go off into other worlds, normally an underworld, an overworld, middle world. You don't do the healing, the shaman does it for you.
I know that in a lot of belief systems and a lot of cultures, the shaman is involved in psychotropic substances. Is that normally the case, or is it sometimes done straight, should we say?
Well, let's put it this way. I was never interested in the psychotropic substances. If you look at the Castaneda books, the Castaneda novels start off with that, sir. You have modern medicine and you have tribal healers. You've always got tribal healers and you've got modern medicine, scientific thought. Now, I was interested in why Westerners were interested in something that was theoretically primitive. Why would somebody who can get penicillin go into a whole thing? Why are they interested in Red Indian stuff? This is the kind of thing that interests me. The fascination with something that was archaic. That was why I was doing the doctorate. But if you look at... In 1953, a guy called Marcy Elliott wrote a book called Shaman. Now, he was the guy who originated comparative religion in the West. And the book of on shamanism is a book about... He did in the library research about Russian-Siberian shamans. But he showed that there was a worldwide view of healing that went on. Most of his stuff was Russian. His idea was it was a universal thing. So he made it something universal. Now, Elliot had his own reasons for doing that. Elliot was, in pre-war Romania, he was the greatest playwright. He was the Mick Jagger of his day. And then he joined a fascist party because he wanted to have a revolution, worldwide revolution of spirit. And the book on shamanism was his book on spirit. And he said, here's a guy who can talk to animals, who can do miracles, who can do... Now, that's interesting in itself. Like, if there's a guy who can actually chat to animals, I want to know about this, okay? I want to find out for there, and are they actually sitting down having conversation with the odd bear? And that's why, if he can do these miracle things, I want to know, I want to see that. And that was my interest in the first place.
Some people pick up a book and have a read and think, oh, that's all very interesting. You spent 5 years. Was there any kind of life-changing conclusions, any information that you came across in that time that you just thought, wow?
Yeah, the information is, there's no information, it's an experience. You know, so to tell somebody, the whole thing with any religion is not the fact, it's doing the process. If you want to know about being a Muslim, you've got to go and bow down, actually pray 5 times a day. If you want to find out, do the stuff. Don't read the books, do the stuff. So if you want to know about shamanism, you've got to actually go and do it because it's an experience.
questions, answers, whatever you want, just send them to podcast@documentally.com.
Could you stick a card in the local post office and call yourself a shaman?
People do that, but I don't do that because I know what, you know, I know what people go through to become a shaman, and that's not what I've ever done.
So you took, you've obviously got quite a scientific mind.
Yeah, I'm a sort of Western intellectual. Let's get that one correct from the beginning.
Did that get in the way at all?
Yes, I think it did. It got in the way massively. But my purpose in all these things was to change me. It wasn't necessarily to change the world. I was experimenting personally. I wanted to find out something for myself. My doctorate, I have a degree from Surrey, a master's degree in change. I did the doctorate when I'd sold a company I'd built up. I'd built up with some other people, and I worked for other people, and I built the company. I sold my shares with it. And I found myself in a situation of having money for the first time in my life and nothing. You know, I'd built up this thing, I'd worked every day and 18 hours some days and really worked for about 20 odd years, nothing, a great hole. I'd fallen into the great midlife crisis. So in those situations, I always go back to the last point of reference when I was successful, and I'd taken a degree. Sorry, I thought, well, I'll go back and do another degree. I started doing the doctorate. You do, first of all, a year of research. Technology, you know, how you do research. Then they say, what do you want to do? I thought, Christ, I don't have a fucking clue. Shamanism. You know, that was about it. It was because it seemed so, no one was going to do it. It was either going to be, I want to talk to people who've been kidnapped by aliens or something like that. I was interested in phenomena, not whether it happened or it didn't happen. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in people saying, this has made a difference to me.
Did you get to meet many shamans in person?
I met two what I call proper shamans in person, quite a few other people who are abusive, and, you know, it's a very difficult world.
Whereabouts were the real shamans?
Well, I met one in Britain who is from Guatemala and who's Swiss as well. It's Martin Pretschel, who's quite well, beautiful writer, very good artist, and very, very good instructor. And Nicholas Noblewolf I worked with in America, who's got fantastic integrity. The problem is you're placing yourself into a very strange situation, a very personal situation with somebody who you don't know, and you're doing it for money. So this is quite difficult. The idea of spirituality, you know, being free, this is a trade. People learn a profession. It's a dangerous profession to learn.
Why dangerous?
Because you can go balmy doing it. You know, the whole point about the shaman is he swims where schizophrenics sink. Right, so, you know, you can get into real trouble. It's dangerous, okay?
I can see that on a T-shirt.
But the reality is, you know, they used to do it for money, but with the village. You were part of a community. Now, most of that knowledge died, especially because my specialty is North American stuff, North American Indians. Their religion was banned in the 1880s. Absolutely everything was stopped, completely banned. And didn't get unbanned to 1976. Now, you might think that America has got laws allowing the freedom of religion, but they do not apply on the reservation, because the reservation is outside of America. It's a protected nation. And American Indians are banned from that. And the reservations were passed out to different churches. So,
so much for human rights then.
Well, they had no human rights. Forget that. Most American Indians were brought up Christian. But with American Indian culture, the idea of one faith is not relevant. They're very pragmatic. So people like Black Elk, who's like the Moses of modern traditional work, he was Catholic as well. He was a very devout Catholic and a traditional Indian.
Well, you wouldn't think the two could go hand in hand.
Well, they can go. That's the great thing about being an Indian. They can hold two or three realities. They don't have to have one true faith. That doesn't mean anything to them. So they could pick up things like learn to use a rifle and still use a bow and arrow if they want to. It's not a big issue to them.
Talking about realities, I mean, the shaman would exist on other realities other than our physical existence. Do you think these other realities are of the mind, or?
Well, he's not flung, you know, Castaneda doesn't turn into a crow physically. I mean, you can't do that. Molecules won't do that. Now, that doesn't happen. And there's a lot of trickery. You're dealing in the middle of the desert. You're not dealing with, like, high... If you go to the movies now, you can do anything with computers. The shaman's on his own. He's like a conjuring guy. There's trickery and stuff, but...
So it's all an illusion?
Yeah. Okay, let's start with it. It's all an illusion. Let's go to Castaneda books. They're novels. Castaneda didn't leave the library either. Right? This is a nonsense. But having said that, you read them and you get changed. You think, wow, there's possibility out there. So the illusion and the reality are very highly mingled. You can't say, you know, I will say categorically, Castaneda books are fiction. I don't care if you got a doctorate for that or not. You should never have done that. And his genius was conjuring his thesis through. That was a work of genius. But all of the stuff in there, there's two books by Richard DeMille that absolutely deconstruct it, and they're very good. DeMille's got no axe to grind on it. All those books say, look, everything here you can find somewhere else, which is true. There's also, I've been to some of the places he claims to have been. When he was walking around the middle of the desert, you fry an egg on those rocks. You don't walk around, you know, you die. The whole thing's wrong, but that's not to say he doesn't know anything. He was doing this in 1961, he was interested in stuff, and he turns the racial thing on its head. There's a part at the beginning, I think, of the first Don Juan novel where he says, well, he's a doctorate student and he's working with this Indian, and the Indian says, do you think you're better than me? He says, basically, yes, because you're nothing, you're just a little pimp. You know, that really turns the whole racial thing on its head. He's studying with this fucked up old Indian guy, you know. No, it's nonsense. There's two books. His wife wrote a book that said basically she saw him every day. How can you see someone every day when he's out in the desert for 6 months? He saw him every single day. He was the guy who liked to be at home.
You're shattering illusions with every sentence.
Oh, no, well, and at the same time you read him and say, wow, there is a world of the imaginal. There was a thirst. For in the West, there's such a thirst for possibility, for the use of the imagination, for something fabulous.
Is this why you started on your quest?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I thought there must be something more than this. And also, there are different kinds of people. I'm a person who can really live very well with imagination. That's what I like. I'm not as scientific as I should be.
What did you find then?
What did I find? I found there was a wonderful world of mythology that if you allowed it to change you, you have to allow it to change you. That's what you find. Let's say talking to trees. Okay, a tree does not have ears and a mouth. You can't do that. But if you sit in front of a tree and actually try and create something there... If you play like it's real, then you find you say something in your head and something else comes back. And you can have a conversation of which the tree creates a form of that. There is a relationship there.
If in your work as a psychotherapist, somebody came to you and said they were sat there talking to trees and somebody recommended they come to see you, what would you say to them?
You come to the right place. You come to the right guy. Look, people come in, they have past lives, they have all this thing. I'm interested in that as a psychological phenomenon. What's it say about them? What's it say about their lives?
You don't think there's any magic in shamanism, in the world, in this reality?
Magic is what people say. I'd like to be able to walk through a wall, okay? We've got a door there. That's fucking magic. Right? That enables you to walk through walls. Look, now, if you forget that's amazing, you need to do some work. That's all I'm saying.
Everything's magic then.
Well, yeah, there is a magic here, but it's everyday magic. It's not like you can struggle to walk through walls all your life, and you'll go balmy in the end. It's, you know, why do that? There are doors.
I went off 8-odd years travelling because I was searching. And I thought I'd stumbled one day upon the secret of happiness. And it can be almost be explained in what you've just said.
Yes.
In a sentence, the secret of happiness is not in the acquisition of more, but in developing the capacity to enjoy less.
Well, that's certainly a shamanic path. Certainly, you know, Native American friends haven't got very much.
How do you feel about things like Reiki and...
No comment, I don't know. You know, I've been Reiki'd, it didn't make a lot of difference to me, but other people think it's fabulous. So these are horses for courses. My wife's a homeopath, and I realize, for me, homeopathy works, acupuncture works, Reiki, I'd have a go at it, didn't work for me, but... You know, there are horses for courses, and shamanism is a horse for a course for modern people.
Yeah.
And the drug thing, you can go on a shamanic retreat for a couple of weeks and have no experiences whatsoever. But if you take the drugs, you're going to come back with something from your holiday. So you've got this drug tourism where you go to Peru for 2 weeks, and you know, you could take acid and stay at home, you're going to have a trip. But you go out there, you take Ayushka or whatever it is, and then you, you know, bang a few drums, and you come back, you've done something, you have an experience you can tell people about. That's not shamanism, that's fucking about with drugs in the middle of the jungle. And if you want to do that, that's great. But I wasn't interested in that, I was interested in the stretching of the imagination, finding out more about yourself, etc. And there's a lot of things, Jungian psychotherapy has got a lot of similar things. Probably wrong to say that, but there's a lot of things on visualization and working with, you know, they work with animals. You could work anything at all.
A lot of these exercises in imagination seem to me to be almost recapturing childhood. I mean, we didn't have a problem with make-believe. We didn't have a problem talking to trees.
No.
All the kinds of things that seem to be suppressed and squished out of you by society... When you reach an age, they say you shouldn't be doing that anymore.
Yeah.
Could that be to our detriment then? Should we be more like children?
Not when you're an adult, no. There's several stages of life. The first stage is you're, you know, struggling to be brought up, and then you leave home, and you have to have an adult life that works in the world. And it's always a pisser if you're going around talking to trees and things like that. You don't get on very well at work, right? This is... You know,
Charles does.
Huh?
Prince Charles.
Yeah, because he already had the job, okay? But there comes a time, you said it like, it's not like constipation. There comes a time when you get too blocked up and you need to start again bringing some of those childhood things in. You're getting in touch with that childhood state.
How has your shamanistic studies really aided you in what you do now then, in psychotherapy?
I think it may be, the shaman I work, Nicholas Noblewolf, I work with, is incredibly kind. I think one of the things I really learned of him is politeness and kindness. That may sound weird.
It does a little bit, yeah.
It does sound weird, yeah. But I mean, the human value he gave me, he was an incredibly kind man. Very boundaried, strict in, you know, he'd say things like, we're in the middle of a desert now, you do exactly what I say because I know what I'm doing, not because I'm in charge, you know, but you just do what I say. He's boundaried. But at the same time, he's very kind. He had that wonderful politeness and gentleness that some Americans have. And he impressed me a lot on that level.
From what you said, I can kind of draw parallels from the shaman instigates the person that comes to them by bringing, allowing them to bring things forward and bring things out. And it's the same way psychotherapy.
Yeah, through. Very similar. But you're always working with what's around you. So with Nick, I work with him in the Gulch areas of Utah, which is like a wilderness area. And we were there for 2 weeks, and no radios, no TV, no nothing like that. And you're working with just meditating on, a lot of it's meditation. Spend some time being with a rock. And you sit down, how the fuck am I going to be with a rock? What am I going to do? So you've got to be with a rock, and suddenly you see something, you think, it's interesting, isn't it? Interesting how the rock's been here for thousands of years. It doesn't do anything. I'm running around. You know, I'm running around trying to do things and the rock just here. Yeah, it sounds weird, but, you know, you're hanging out with a rock. Mm. Now, you don't want to put on your CV, he has hung around with rocks, right? It makes you look like a real fool. But the truth is, by slowing you down and allowing you to actually get in touch with something you are part of, which is the earth, then it makes a giant difference to you.
It's a completely different perspective to what people that are rushing around tend to see. Taking yourself out of yourself for a moment, almost. Yeah. This is all very shamanistic as well.
Well, people running around need to spend some time stopping running around, and sometimes go to Zen retreats or they do Buddhism or whatever. Great. This is just another type of thing where you can slow down and spend some time doing something quite natural.
Being present in the moment.
Being present in the moment and learning about stars. See, right here, we don't get to see many stars. We're a bit relative. We're 400 foot up here, and you know it's a bit cloudy. But if you go to sort of the high Sierras, stars are really close. And Native Americans had a relationship. They have relationships with the stars. They feel like they're part of the world. I think that's an important thing. You get to feel you are part of the world, not something separate.
It's a belonging, it's a...
Yeah, it is a belonging and a responsibility. And the relationship with gods are different. Very, very different. If you take Genesis, which is fundamental to all Western thought, we are created by a distant god. We're not part of that god. We are separate from that god. Now, that's different from most religions. Creation stories will say something like, God opens his wrists and the rivers flow, and then he does this. And he is part of it, and you are part of that. There's a part of God within you. That's a much closer relationship. And the part of God that is within you is the bit that is important. So Native Americans might call their body the robe. They'll be leaving the robe behind, you know. But it doesn't mean they're not part of something. The robe's a temporary thing. And in fact, in that, the Judas Testament of Judas, which has just been found, National Geographic, I think, Christ says to Judas, you will sacrifice the man that clothes me. So there's an idea of the clothing, the body being the clothing to the soul. So Native Americans might say that, or they might say, your soul has a body, which is something else. So here we argue, do we have a body and a mind? Is the mind and body different? That's just a very low-level argument. The real argument is, you know, is the soul, does the soul have a body? Does the body have a soul? It's much bigger. And to think in those terms. And so you can say science and shamanism can coexist really easily, because you say things like, Nick Noblewolf said to me, we're talking about the moon, we're looking at it, it's really beautiful. And science will tell us what it's made of, but it won't tell us what it is. That's different. What it is different. And you can either say it looked like a national car park up there, it's absolutely nothing there, or you can say, I have a relationship with that. You are not separate, you are part of everything. That includes rocks and trees.
You are listening to Documentary.
If we kind of segregate the relationship between science, spirituality and religion, what percentage?
Religion, that'd be very little science.
Very little science?
Very little science.
So you're a religious, spiritual person or purely religious?
I'm spiritual. Religious, I'm a Jew.
Okay.
Okay.
Practicing?
No. Well, I practice. whatever I do is a Jewish thing to do, you know, because I am a Jew.
Okay.
So, you know, that's what I am. But I don't hold with some parts, I don't hold others. I was brought up like that, so I was brought up in a very religious way.
It's a within you kind of... It's not been indoctrinated, are you saying? It's something...
No, well, that was indoctrinated. I was brought up that way. I don't think you could... breeding is partly indoctrination. You've got to bring up kids in a culture. I was brought up in that culture. But spiritually, it didn't feed me. I had to go and find something else as well to bring into that, to bring into my world. Okay. And so I'm not you have people who are shamanists who go around, they do all the shamanic things and they do that. That's part of their identity. It's not part of my identity, but something I learnt a lot from and have a great time for. The lady who runs the body shop, Anita Rolick, told me something. She said when she was in America, she was looking around for causes to put money into the body shop could back. And she was contacted by a tribe in the middle of bloody nowhere, and they wanted to come and have a talk with them. They were quite prescient, they knew what they were doing. And we got down there, and I said, well, we've got no money at all, can you help us? And she said, well, you've got tons of sage here. I'll make a sage face pack or something. She didn't care. She's just going to use the sage. She'll have a face rub, a sage rub, and who knows, you know. Anyway, they said, well, okay, that sounds great. We'll have to ask the sage. So come back the next day, and the elders say, no, the sage doesn't want this. And that was the end of that. Right? That sounds weird to us in the West because it makes no sense. But what a fantastic thing to include the very object that's going to be sacrificed, to include it.
You're surrounded by all kinds of plants, trees, bushes. I mean,
yeah.
So they're not just aesthetic for you. Do you actually have a relationship with them?
I did learn from Nick how to treat a tree, you know, because I come to cut down trees here. Some are old and some I need wood, etc.
Do you ask their permission?
Oh, I certainly do. And, you know, it may be a superstitious thing now because I think if I didn't ask for permission, something pretty awful could happen. But I do, and I also allow them to pray. It's the showing respect for self, not necessarily for the tree, because the tree is part of you in that way.
Mm.
Now, that may sound stupid, but it's a better way to live, as far as I can see. You know, it changes the way you live by having a relationship with the world. Not a relationship like we should be doing that, but actual physical, a feeling relationship to things that are present. And you have, you know, in the Old Testament, you've got things like, you know, God gave man dominion over the earth. Well, that doesn't mean it's yours to pillage. It means it's yours to look after. That's a different thing completely.
Voi sentite de documentali.
All these influences you've experienced with your work as a psychotherapist.
Yes.
Where do you draw from the most? Is there a particular school of thought, a particular teaching, a particular experience you've personally had?
Working with shamans gave me enormous empathy for indigenous peoples. It really turned me off anthropology a lot. Looking at some of the early anthropological work and the politics of it was quite difficult. It's as if Native Americans, for instance, are so different. They're the shadow side of American culture. And both could learn fabulously from each other. You know, if America as a whole, or the West as a whole, could learn some of the Native American stuff, that would make a major difference to the way we live, in my view.
When you say shadow side, you mean it's kind of a yin to the yang? And
yeah, it's a yin to the yang. It's the thing that we don't want to be, but a part of us that's there, it's insistent. Yeah, I think it changed me enormously. And you've got to be careful on, you know, choosing. It took me about a year to choose a shaman, that was the first thing. Because I went around and saw quite a lot of people. And I thought, this is bullshit, I don't get this, I have no feeling for that guy. I put the same care into that I would in choosing a therapist.
Is that the only way to tell a shaman from a charlatan?
Well, you know, it's up to you. Whether a charlatan or a shaman is up to the viewer, really. Mm. But there are shamanic cults and things you can join if you really are quite lonely. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of pitfalls here. Because the old shamanic thing is, certainly in America, is dead and has been revived. So a shaman doesn't have the same tribal support as he had. There is a lot of animosity for any shaman working with whites or passing on stuff to whites. That really is considered terrible now. It wasn't in the 60s, but now it's considered not good at all. And shamans, there's no like moral stuff there. If someone says, I've got shamanic powers, everyone will test them out. You know, they want to see this. They're not interested in claims.
You must have felt a lot of things, obviously, but did you see anything that you thought, well, that's a pretty good illusion, or...?
I did, but that's very personal. So I really, you know, this is not, you know, into a crow and flew across. I didn't do that.
This isn't for fear. I mean, I had an incredible, incredible, unexplainable experience during Kundalini yoga.
Yeah.
Where the only way I can explain it is that I was sat inside 5 a.m. in the morning after about an hour of meditation, and it felt like someone had turned a hot shower head of energy above me, and it just went straight through my head, through my entire body. I can't explain that feeling. You know, someone might say, oh, it's, you know, pins and needles coming from the head down, but...
Yes. Well, those Kundalini experiences are, you know, are well documented, and anything I've had, you know, it's not badly documented. But I did say, I did have experience enough to say, there is really something enormous here, and I don't have the time.
Really? Couldn't have been that big then.
No, it is big. I have a life as well. I mean, Nick Noblewolf himself has spent at least 8 years as a trainee to somebody else. I know the word apprentice is used a lot, but he's not an apprentice. An apprentice means you're going to take over from that shaman.
So he's kind of got a guru.
Yeah, most of the relationships now are like guru-type relationships, because unless you are working within a tribal situation, you're not apprentice, because then you'd have to take over Pueblo rituals and things like that, which you're not going to do. That's not going to happen. But you have trainees, and very few of them get through.
So you stumbled upon the potential, yet you still felt work was more important elsewhere? Or?
Well, I had things to do. I didn't really... I was doing a doctorate.
Which is ultimately more important than enlightenment?
I didn't want to get enlightened. I'd been enlightened. Well, enlightenment was something that I was involved with in Exegesis. As far as I was concerned, I was enlightened in 1977.
You are an enlightened being now, or you were enlightened?
I was enlightened in 1977. Enlightenment is like... it's not like a badge. You can't wear enlightenment. You're enlightened and then you're not enlightened. It's like you see something, then you don't see something. Mm. You don't, you know. It's not game over. Enlightenment, that's just a sort of part and parcel. You gain enlightenment. Some people gain enlightenment, they're also good teachers, they are able to hold that experience, carry that experience forward, teach it to others.
So what did it feel like?
What?
Being enlightened.
Great.
Something like, boing. There's another t-shirt there. Enlightenment is great.
But what can you say? What can you say? It's beyond words. You just go like, boing. And then, you know, there's other stuff coming.
But you'd think that enlightenment is kind of the answer to all and everything.
Well, perhaps it is. I mean, we're dealing in concepts that are beyond definition.
This company, Exegesis.
Exegesis, yes.
How much did people pay to be enlightened?
In 1977, I think they're paying £169. I think it went up to £230.
And how long did it take?
How long did it what take?
Enlightenment.
3 days.
3 days.
3 days.
I spent 8 years when I should have just spent £160. Although I guess it's
probably... £230, and you got your money back if you didn't get what you wanted. Okay.
You are joking.
No, I swear. If you didn't feel at the end of it you'd got good value out of it, you had your money back. It was quite straightforward.
So, the people coming to you, and after 3 days they're enlightened, or at least...
No, hang on a second. We didn't say they're enlightened. They may have said, I feel enlightened, right?
Okay.
That's not up to me to say. I'm not a judge. We don't have an enlightenment machine, right?
So this is kind of a compact self-help course.
Whatever you want to describe it. It was about self-exploration for 3 days. Yeah, and it was done on a wholesale level. It wasn't done on one-to-one.
And was the teaching based on any religious...
It was a bit zen, outside of that. No, no religious stuff. Mm. It was more... Well, Zen-based, really, I think.
Anybody ever ask for their money back?
Yeah, about one every seminar would get their money back.
Oh, right.
Now, people did ask for the money and they got it back.
Yeah.
Because I was quite happy to say, you know, if people say, this is shit, but this is shit and it's free, I got my money back. You know, I thought it was shit and I got my money back. I didn't want... See, my view, and I was doing a lot of marketing for it and selling it, was I wanted people to come along and say to people, I really enjoy this, I got off on this.
It sounds like you've got, you know, a completely winning product there.
Three it does days. Sound. You would think that, wouldn't you?
What
you
happened?
Would think that. It, one and one and one and one and one. And then one day we had a guy come marching in who said, I'm having problems at home and I really want to do this. He seemed a nice guy. Got on the seminar. He'd just been fired from the Daily Mirror and we'd given him really his key back in. He said we'd locked him in, we'd put... nails on his chair. All things, you know, I hadn't thought of putting nails on his chair, but he was there for half a morning. He didn't last more than the first morning. And he was off like a hare back to the Daily Mirror for his job back.
Yeah, because he had this great story.
He had a great story, and it was a good story. And then they found people who said, you know, my son was a really nice boy until he went on this. And at the age of 42, he left home. So, you know, they found everybody had been divorced, anyone who didn't like us, which was quite as you make enemies and friends.
Yeah.
And they went to town on it. Now,
consequently to that, we couldn't get leasing. We couldn't get the normal things you need to run a business.
Yeah.
You couldn't. And 20 times more people wanted to do the seminar, but most of them were barking.
Right.
So we had to spend, you know, what started off as a sort of like, it had started off with two people doing humanistic work together, doing cathartic work, doing regression work, all this really interesting stuff, like experimental stuff in the 70s. And then we said, we'll put it together into a seminar for us. Going great. And we got our friends on. That was great. Everything was terrific. It started off called Infinity Trainings. But then we realized that none of us knew what infinity was. We'd never experienced infinity, so we better sort of calm it down. Everything with Exegesis, it was great. And
where,
it was
where did
really
the name
fun.
Come from?
Exegesis means to something from source.
Okay.
And the source was you in this. The idea was you took from yourself. It was an education of putting out, not putting in. And so all the exercises were reflective, where you had to come up with something cathartic. It was very much, you know, nowadays they call it the wham bam thank you man school of enlightenment type of thing. You know, it was too tight. We didn't have much to follow on.
There's people still doing this kind of course along the same lines, or?
Actually, they're in prison if they are.
You are listening to a Documentally podcast.
Can you be enlightened in the same? Is it proportional? Your enlightenment at 28, is it the same as enlightenment at 88?
It won't stop you having a life that has ups and downs. I'm saying you have an experience. Enlightenment is an experience to me, an experience of possibility. You suddenly see something, you go like, yes, it's not the end of the game. People talk about it as if it's a finish. When I worked as a team with people and did this seminar, working with Robert Daubeny, one of my jobs was to vet people on the way in. And they had to spend a lot of time doing a form saying what they wanted. And anyone said, I want enlightenment. I say, great, what's enlightenment to you? How will you know if you're enlightened? Most of it came down, I'd get a girlfriend. You know, it comes down to box standard, you know, what you really want. I want a sports car.
So what you're
car.
Saying is when you found enlightenment, you got laid?
I was getting, that wasn't the bad, you know, I was getting laid at that time. It's just these were the fucking years for me. This one. Yeah, that wasn't the issue. The issue was the sort of like, oh, what's it all about type of thing. Constant searching, you know, nothing's good enough type thing. Oh, I'd have an experience and it wouldn't, yeah, and then what's the next one? Spiritual stuff doesn't make you psychologically sound. It's separate, it's different.
Mm.
But it can give you enormous psychological comfort. You know, they're separate areas. They do overlap, but they are separate.
Just kind of to round off,
mm.
Is there a piece of wisdom? Is there some learning, something you picked up along the way, whether it be through shamanism or your present practices? Is there a piece of wisdom that if you wanted to pass something on,
you could
say now?
Very simple. Religion, shamanism, psychotherapy, whatever, they're processes. They're not ideas. You have to do them to gain benefit. Reading the books doesn't help you. It just gives you more stuff to worry about. You have to go through a process. You don't have to believe in them, but you go through the process and they change you. The process changes you. If you want to know what it's like to be Jewish, keep all the Jewish laws. If you want to know what a Muslim, try that out. Don't bother reading the books, because that's not the point. Okay?
Excellent. Are you happy?
Am I happy now?
Yeah.
There's a great thing in the film The Three Jacks. You know, Three Jakes.
Okay.
It's the follow-up to Chinatown.
Okay.
Or Two Jakes, Three Jakes. Anyway, Jack Nicholson goes to ask the Chinese gardener, and Chinese gardener says to him, are you happy? Jack Nicholson goes, who would know? You know, who knows he's happy? A happy man knows he's happy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
I don't want you listening to any angry music. Songs of madness and obsession.
You have been listening to a Documentally podcast on Documentally.com.
I think I'm going to crash.